Welcome to the Creative Careers in Medicine podcast with your host, Dr. Dana Pang, and myself, Dr. Elise Hutt. Join us as we talk to inspiring clinicians who have redefined their careers.
This week, we're sharing a session from our recent conference, CCIM 24, Meet Me in the Metaverse. This session comes from our Adventure and Expedition Medicine Breakout with APROF Derek Tin, a critical care, counterterrorism, and disaster medicine specialist, sharing his insights from his highly adventurous career to date. If you missed CCIM 24, you can catch this session in full and many more as a virtual attendee. Head to creativecareersinmedicine.com to register. Here's Dr. Tin.
All right, thanks. When Amandeep invited me to come talk at this conference, I said, there's really nothing creative about what I do. So if you're looking for that, this is probably not the talk for you. But what I can offer you is a slightly different, non-traditional, non-mainstream pathway within medicine in a specialty that is of increasingly important and recognized sort of worldwide. So my name is Derek Tin. I'm a disaster medicine specialist. I'm a faculty at Harvard Medical School, where I trained. I spent 2 years there doing my fellowship. I sit on the board of directors for the World Association, and I'm an associate professor of critical care medicine at the University of Melbourne. So in the 20 minutes, I'm going to briefly sort of run through what the world of disaster looks like, what it is, because often people don't know. We're going to go through a bit of some basic definitions. Then I'm going to go through some of the research that I've been doing, which has led to a lot of sort of operational deployments as well. So there's many slides, mostly photos, so hopefully we can get through all of them. But historically, you know, when a disaster happened, the first thought is we have wronged the gods. This is a wrath of the deities upon us, right? This is the Great Day of His Wrath, part of John Martin's series, displayed at the Tate in London. And I don't know whether you can see, it will show basically the force of nature at the top and the helplessness of men at the bottom trying to fight God's will. But of course, our understanding of science and nature today has really evolved since those days, and we now know that our actions can directly influence natural events and that our reactions can alter the subsequent human outcomes. So this whole natural versus man-made, is the delineation is not that quite clear. And of course, if you take global warming as an example, there is now a robust scientific consensus that our actions are indeed leading to many of the climate disasters we are seeing today. And of course, there's now research into how climate is fueling terrorism. And there are certainly a lot of sound arguments that positively correlate the two. And as we know, terrorism and humanitarian crisis often also go hand in hand. And when we start studying disaster medicine, you quickly realize the complex relationships between everything happening around the world. You cannot think of a single event in silo. You cannot think of medicine in silo. A climate event will have impact on geopolitics, population movement, urbanization. It places socioeconomic stress on cities and politicians and can lead to conflict and, in extreme cases, terrorism. But ultimately, whether this is a weather event, a terrorist attack, a refugee crisis, this all really converges back to what we do as disaster medicine specialists. We try and understand how global events can impact population health. We look after the people that are affected en masse, and we look at how the systems can support these sorts of disasters, and we lead organizations through the crises they face. But let's just go back a step. What exactly is a disaster? You know, it's worth remembering that disasters actually form part of a spectrum. We start with an incident that occurs, and if that starts straining the local resources, that becomes a crisis. And of course, when it overwhelms the resources, that by definition becomes a disaster. And that's a really good definition because it's scalable, it's contextual to local systems in place. But what's so difficult about disasters? Simple disasters are relatively predictable. You know, you guys are all doctors, so if I told your local emergency department that there's been a train derailment down the road, you can actually start predicting some injury patterns, despite having never seen a train derailment, right? So based on historic precedents, based on your knowledge of motor vehicle accidents and other sort of traumas, and with some forward thinking, you can start actually planning an appropriate hospital response. But compound disasters, that is when one event sort of precipitates another, are much harder to predict, right? If I now tell you that the train derailed as a result of a terrorist sabotage and that the train was actually carrying highly toxic chemicals, that suddenly introduces a lot of uncertainties and unfamiliarities. It is a little bit, yeah, indeed, that you're very unfamiliar with. And these aren't actually theoretical events I'm talking about. These are actually all happening around us. There may be a bit of sort of a media bias in terms of what we're exposed to, but when you're a DM specialist, you see what's happening all around the world. And what we're seeing are these familiar disasters pop up in unfamiliar forms, and unfamiliar disasters surface in forms not yet imagined. And I wrote about this in the American Journal of Emergency Medicine about 2 years ago. The stacking effects of disasters are very hard to predict. And what we're still lacking is that dark creativity to really explore and imagine worst case scenarios, or what we call black swan events. And this is where we come in. My special interest is looking at how intentional events can inflict mass casualty events, and in particular, conflict and terrorism. And this is where I spent a lot of my time researching and indeed presenting around the world. So some of the research, we looked at the frequency of attacks around the world and by region. We broke down the weapon types used in terror attacks to better understand what clinically we might be dealing with. We looked at the lethalities of each attack modality and look at how the death and injury tolls differ. Of course, we looked at the traditional WMDs, your sort of chem, bio, rad, nuclear attacks. And one of the great things this work allows us to do is it really sort of allows me to interact with professionals that we don't normally have exposure to. Here, you know, we wrote a paper closely with our tactical medicine colleagues in understanding how through our research, we can actually help them improve their preparedness and response algorithms better in these sort of high threat environments. At the bottom was us at the Massachusetts State Hazmat team looking at the array of instruments they use in the field to detect CBRNE weapons or exposures. We took the opportunity during COVID to publish with some of the world's leading infectious disease experts from the Broad Institute, and we looked at the plausibility of using home CRISPR technology to create your own man-made bioweapon in your garage. And we looked at the current issues like the opioid crisis and how that can be potentially be exploited by terrorist cells. This paper was subsequently picked up by the US federal government, and we were actually asked to present some of our findings and thoughts at the White House, and we did that last year. This paper, one of the most sort of favorite papers I wrote. I wrote this with two professors of criminology, specifically looking at how suicide bombing terrorism kill 10 times more than conventional bombing. So it's really fascinating, not just the psychosocial idealism behind that, but actually the clinical impacts are actually quite different. Cyber threats already at our doorstep and a huge focus here at home in Australia as well as abroad. We spent many hours with the federal government in the US where I predominantly work talking about cyber threats, cyber attacks on healthcare systems. Do we punish the healthcare system, or is this a national security issue where we as a federal government need to actually help protect them? And this really feeds into what we call hybrid warfare, a big topic of discussion because there's sort of many complex moving parts, mix of conventional warfare, irregular warfare, terrorism, criminality, and all this happening in the civilian setting where you and I now have to deal with the aftermath. We started this before the most recent Ukrainian-Russian conflict. We wrote this obviously before Gaza and Palestine, and now many of my colleagues around the world are now citing these papers. They're picking it up thinking, we know you've been talking about this for years. We never thought this would happen, even though at the time you said this is happening. So very relevant, unfortunately, in the world we live in today. So these concepts are not new, but obviously in these times of global unrest, the development of these has really been accelerated. And unfortunately for us, if you don't start at least trying to understand some of the impact these things have, it's very hard for you to then mitigate these risks and how to respond to these events. And this is a reality of modern day threats, right? This is a reality of many civilians and the hospitals are facing Ukraine. We published this paper that documented all the damage to infrastructure in the healthcare sector, and this will subsequently likely be used in the International Court of War Crimes to prosecute Russian war crimes. Now, of course, with all this research comes the endless sort of conferences and presentations, lots of advisory work to governments. We spent a lot of time in the UAE where we help them develop a system to respond to these events, not just intentional events, but also natural disasters, EMS capabilities, surge capacity, which really falls under our remit as well. In the last year, I think I've been Saudi, Germany, UAE, and I've got about 9-10 trips lined up this year alone overseas. So all very interesting sort of work. And if you get lucky enough and your stuff is interesting enough, you get to collaborate with the big ones, right? The United Nations, the WHO, and even the Secret Service actually came knocking on our doors a couple of times. And I helped them, a couple of funny stories there, but I essentially helped them looking at how we embed medical workforce in active shooter events because it's such a prominent issue in the US. So do we train the medic in security so we embed them, or do we train the security guys in doing a bit of medicine in stabilizing gunshot wounds? So, but you know, all this is academic presentations. If you're not into, that's fine. And I'm really a sort of boots on ground kind of person. And I'm not the sort of do an academic high five and leave it at that. So I'm more about translating some of the research and science into operational needs. So we launched this pre-deployment course that we run at Harvard for emergency physicians. We basically run them out through realistic hostile checkpoints and physically and psychologically stress them out as they're trying to, in this scenario, evacuate an injured colleague in the middle of the night and see how they react, right? This is micro-stress them to help build a degree of resilience to some capacity. We specifically train our guys in tactical emergency casualty care, so how to operate in an austere and high-threat environment, how to prioritize medicine based on the threat situation. Of course, TCCC stems from military medicine, the TCCC, and how do we translate some of the lessons learned in the military combat field into the civilian setting? And interestingly, after we ran this course, you know, before we ran this, a couple of the guys came up and said, look, I don't know that I'll ever need this. You know, I live in US, big urban city. And about 4 weeks after this, two of them deployed into, not quite Ukraine, but on the border in Poland. And they didn't face sort of high threat environments, but at least it's primed them into understanding what it's like to be embedded with a security element or security team. Every year we're involved in the race operations at the Boston Marathon. So that's me as a race, as a medical lead. And my job is to specifically look at potential vulnerabilities and threats and how that can impact the system in place and how we can change the response setups in the future. We do that with the Gillette Stadium during the games where they host big concerts for many venues around the world. Boston's probably not the best place because they're so highly resourced. They have everything on standby all the time. And all that aside, the textbook, academic aside, you know, over there they were talking about sort of leadership. I spent 6 months at Harvard's MPLI training in crisis leadership. I'm one of their first global ambassadors. So if anyone's got interest in understanding more about medical leadership, please come to speak to me. And my job often is not necessarily on the ground doing clinical work, but usually sits at a leadership level trying to make non-medics or non-medical people understand why we have to prioritize medicine in a certain way, right? But at the same time, trying to understand everyone's mission goals and trying to align them so that we can have a good outcome. Rich Serino on the left was the 8th deputy administrator of FEMA. He was President Obama's right-hand man, led him through over 60 disasters during his time. And on the left, Deval Patrick, ex-Massachusetts governor, ex-presidential nominee, who led Boston through the marathon bombing, which obviously was a big event in that region. So really taught by some of the best in the world, I would say, and really armed me with the confidence to actually be able to sit in the big board and actually deal with the crisis and manage it sensibly. Now, of course, the other side is we deploy. Head torch, as Lachlan said. And this is me many years ago on a maritime rescue team in the Indian Ocean and then subsequently in the South Pacific where we build field hospitals. That's a drawing of a rescue given to us by a kid we rescued. And this is one of the more moderated ones. Just before COVID, I was in Zambia training medics in prolonged field care in austere and remote environments. I wouldn't say it's a high threat environment, probably low to moderate threat. We spent a week camping into the national park, hunting our own food. When I say food, it's the black leches that we're supposed to be also protecting, which I thought was a bit ironic, but that's okay. And then we graduated about 12 dozen every year. We try and graduate into basic, they're trained at the level of the US equivalent of a combat medic, so they can do sort of basic stabilization stuff. And the team subsequently deployed into neighboring Mozambique, to deal with the aftermath of Typhoon Ida. So very satisfying when these guys send me photos through WhatsApp, even though they're just putting on bandage on and probably not a pretty shitty bandage, quite honestly. But still satisfying to know that we've been part of some program that is trying to make a difference. Of course, back home in Australia, I was in the thick of things during the 2019 bushfires. Many of you would have been involved in that. And shortly after that, of course, COVID-19, I'm sure all of us were involved in some capacity or another. This was me in February 2020. So right before you guys were even thinking about N95s, this is what I already had in stock. Two custom ambulances. We had negative pressure pod, transfer pods. Every single team member had PAPA units, so world-class PAPA units. We didn't even bother using N95s. Everyone was fit tested for every single mask beforehand as well. Obviously, during COVID, we didn't do really a lot of deployment per se, but most of us were involved in COVID, which itself was a big sort of natural sort of disaster. So, but I won't talk too much about that. In 2022, I was invited by the US Navy Surgeon General as a subject matter expert to go on the USNS Comfort. We went through South America, Honduras, Haiti, Colombia, setting up temporary field hospitals to look after those who can't access healthcare, and did a lot of training with the navies. We reaccredited them in their tactical combat care training as well. And to finish this, this is a line that sort of stuck with me over the years. You know, the world of disaster medicine is really about providing care where the most vulnerable deserve the best of standards in the worst of times. And I think this really emphasizes what we should all aspire to achieve, but especially perhaps more for those in the world of disaster medicine. And look, I hope the talk, as I said, there's nothing really creative about it, but I hope it gives you a glimpse of what this, you know, emerging subspecialty looks like. Many of you, as you go on with careers, will probably be involved with some sort of disaster or mass casualty event, but know that there's training there, know that leadership training is important. I always find it interesting. We talk so much about leadership. As doctors, you expect to be able to lead. Yet at Harvard, we train the leaders and still see bad leaders. So you really need to be trained to do that job. That's just a collage of all the stuff I've done or some of the stuff I've done. That's most of you should be old enough to recognize 9/11. So I was there. I was a medical student at the time and I really didn't think much of it. I wasn't my country, but interestingly, the professor that runs a fellowship at Harvard was probably about two blocks south of where I took this photo at that time. That's what made his career in disaster medicine, and that's what sort of led him into that field. Usual QR code, I'm pretty active on LinkedIn, so if anyone wants to connect or chat, I'm happy to, and thank you very much. That's it.
Thanks for listening to the Creative Careers in Medicine podcast, a proud member of the Talking Health Tech podcast network. Visit the Creative Careers in Medicine website in the show notes of this episode for more resources to help you find the courage, confidence, and skills to take control of your career and forge your own unique path. The Creative Careers in Medicine podcast acknowledges the traditional owners of country throughout Australia and recognises the continuing connection to lands, water, and community. We pay our respects to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures and to elders past, present, and emerging.